Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we talk about resignations.
And Patrick Maguire joins us in the New Statesman podcast broom cupboard. So, Stephen, where were you when you heard about Ben Branshaw and Rhea Caulfield's resignations?
When I heard about Ben Bradley.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, no.
I mean, to be honest, if Ben Bradshaw resigned, I think that actually would be
a kind story.
So I was at my desk in Westminster, which obviously I share with Patrick and Labourist Sienna Rogers. We all looked at each other and, no, actually, we looked at each other and went back to talking about the forthcoming game between France and Croatia.
So just in case our listeners haven't been hooked by the later stages of the Tory psychodrama, obviously we had David Davis's resignation on late on Sunday night, then we had Boris Johnson's on Monday, Theresa May made a statement, then another guy whose name I've already forgotten, I want to say Chris.
I actually struggled with this yesterday. Chris Green.
Chris Green, who was a PPS at Transport.
Chris Green is the ultimate nightmare MP because his surname is a colour and the Bolton constituencies are all named after compass points, but it's a classic bad constituency name and the compass points do not really make sense.
Right, there's like a northwest and then there's just an east, isn't there? There's like, there was one, they don't...
And I want to say he's the MP for northwest, but he, as a result, I often refer to him as Chris North, the MP for West Green.
Right.
And it's just a bit of
nonetheless, you won't have to refer to him at all, really, because he's returned to the backbench, prompting another tweet from another Tory MP, maybe my favourite tweet of the week, which said, what was it? Quote, you're a PPS. No one gives a bleep. I mean, I do, obviously. Right? That was some prime Tory beef that was aired.
I don't know. I'm slightly concerned that one of the many jobs under threat as a result of Brexit is that of criminologist, because it's not like you really need kind of a three-part blog from me explaining the intricacies of what that row means, right? You know, they've effectively, I really thought we were the one industry that Brexit could not kill was people explaining the intricacies of Tory beef. In fact, I would have thought Brexit would be a boom
for that
industry. But it turns out they've just decided to, you know,
it's a bit like that
make
tweet
it a
that
clean
guy did,
sweep.
Like, I've worked on this story for 20 months and he just tweeted it out. That was our version of that. So, yeah, so obviously one of the currents that tweet exchange exposed was the fact that the kind of non-wing nut, oh, I think I probably can say that, the non-Brexit ultra faction of the Tory party are a bit annoyed that they just keep marching loyally through the lobbies, getting on with it, rowing in behind Theresa May, and then the headbanger constituency have decided, as they see it, kind of to hold the party to ransom.
And yeah, then, although the thing about people like Ben Bradley and Maria Caulfield is they're not
right.
Really,
so let's move on to them. They're Tory vice chairs, right? Yeah. And they both resigned on Wednesday. So they're slightly, and they're in a slightly different category.
Yeah, they're not really kind of primordial Brexiteers. They both believe, and this is like a really fascinating collective action problem, right? Because if you're the average Leave voter, so you're 60-something, retired, living in a small town without much immigration, what is the tangible sign to you that you have received a good or a bad Brexit? Answer, is the NHS in a better or worse state, which is actually why the most important policy lever for them to have pulled is to spend more on the NHS, even though, of course, that has nothing to do with a Brexit dividend of any kind. However, the other clue will be how various elites on your side respond to the deal. Now, the weird thing, of course, that means is that it's notionally in the Conservative Party's interest for MPs in marginal seats not to resign, going, I can't defend this, my constituents will eat them. But of course, because at least one of them will always do that, right? you know, you might be able to get the... So the Mail, very fascinatingly, is covering this through the lens of its criminology. The Sun is covering it as a blue-on-blue fight, but the Telegraph is covering it as she's a traitor, she's a traitor. And because there will never be a situation where if you're the Tory party, you can get everyone on the right to act in a enlightened and self-interested way, it's actually in everyone's individual interests to do what Ben Bradley has done, which is try and inoculate yourself locally. But of course, that won't work either, because the problem is it will always be in someone's interest to say that the Brexit deal is back.
And as we know, personal votes are a lot. And his majority is, I think, 1,076, and his constituency voted 17.9% in favour of Brexit. I mean, that is a Leavey constituency right there. But what's Ben Bradshaw up to, the Labour MP for Exeter?
Well, Ben Bradshaw actually is a kind of a good segue into the other sort of part of this, right? So crucially, right, the reason why conservative Brexiteers are saying we'll keep resigning till she changes her mind is they know if she doesn't change her mind, they have no other mechanism to change policy. They can't replace her as leader. And if they did, you know, one Tory MP said to me sort of last week, they were just like, well, you know, the thing that people do forget is only the fact that people still feel that Theresa May is secretly on their side and that she moves towards them a soft Brexit position whenever she can means that people, pro-Europeans, haven't just said, well, I'm just going to torch the place. The second you end up with Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the incentives to kind of play nicely if you're a Tory pro-European have gone out the window. And the Brexit ultras know that as well, right? They know that they don't have the numbers to change the leadership. If they do change the leadership, it makes their problem in Parliament worse, not better. And they can't change her mind. And they have surrendered the one arena where you can still influence policy, which is being in the cabinet.
So you and I have written a cover story this week. One of the things that I enjoyed about that was you had this thing I did about the European Research Group, this much feared kind of Tory MPs grouping, about 80 Tory MPs. And you said, you know, but the numbers of that are a bit misleading because it's a bit like one of those societies that you join in Freshers Week at university when you go around the fair and you just sign up to everything, which I thought was a really useful point. Because I think that we might get the feeling over the next couple of weeks that the Brexiteers' bark is actually kind of, or the hard Brexiteers' bark is a lot worse than their bite in terms of what they're able to accomplish. But the other thing that we talked about in our cover story is the looming meaningful vote, which I mean, looks like a proper runaway mine train to me. Like, I just don't know how you get that through. You've written in your free morning email about the possibility of like having a second vote, like the debt ceiling vote that the US had, right, where they just had to keep, or was it, there was the financial bailout.
It was the troubled asset relief program. Where actually the dynamics are quite similar, right? You have a left-wing party who, there are various things about this Brexit deal that it is not going to like, and also it is in its political interests to vote against it. I just cannot imagine a situation in which on the first time the deal comes to Parliament, it is just ever than anyone in the Labour Party will think, hey, do you know what would be a great idea politically?
I'm a vote with the Tories.
Yeah.
Do you know what my constituents are going to love? Do you know what my activists are going to love?
Yeah, it's just like your activists aren't going to like it. Remain or leave, I can't see how you can sell it to your own voters. But of course, what happened with TARP is enough Republicans turned out to be ideologically committed to this idea of no bailouts that it failed the first time. The market, of course, plunged. There were all sorts of, you know, and there were lots of long run, that created long run problems in terms of economic growth and people's jobs in the United States and indeed across the rest of the world. But then what happened was is you had a bill which moved slightly towards what Democrats wanted, which passed with the votes of Democrats. And the long-lasting casualties of that were the economy, of course, and crucially, the Republican Party's the Republican Party went down to landslide defeat in 2008. And in terms of the internal balance of that political party, it is hard to sustain the argument that they have recovered, right? They are in power. They control all three branches of government, admittedly, thanks to a very weird electoral system. But still, you know, all of that aside, we have a pretty weird electoral system here too. And you can see how they might be able to leverage out that kind of control. But the damage that the Republican Party sustained is still ongoing.
I mean, it really was. Like, I think Obama had a super majority in the Senate in his first, after his first set of elections, right? Which is, you know, I mean, that was one of the big strikes against Obama, as people say, well, he should have been able to be much more bold in his first year when he had such a big majority. But anyway.
And I think it is quite likely, you know, maybe for various electoral reasons, the kind of the sort of thumping Labour result afterwards doesn't happen. But it feels to me likely that there will be at least 7 Conservative MPs who decide to vote against it. I do not believe there will be a big enough countervailing wave of Labour defections, because if Tory leavers don't like it, Labour leavers aren't going to like it either. And I think that it will not be anywhere near soft enough. You know, I mean, there are pro-Europeans in the Labour Party who know full well that if they voted for it, it would be the end of their career. But if the deal was single market customs union, they would go, well, that is, I am willing for this to be the last line of my political life. But they're not going to do that for, you know,
maximum facilitated partnership. Yeah, some deal for goods.
And yeah, I mean, that is not a price that they're willing to pay. So I think it feels to me fairly likely that the first time the deal is voted down, there will, of course, then be a kind of fairly immediate economic, you know, kind of markets will panic. We will at that point start to be, yeah, because there's other thing kind of, so the Sun has kind of written up, oh, the government is getting to stockpile canned foods to show Brussels it means the threat of no deal. And you're just like, I mean, is that really your take home? Then we're going to show them because we're going to stockpile canned food.
I don't really like canned food. I ate a lot of canned food in my childhood. And one of the great things about being an adult is I eat a lot less canned food now.
Yeah, I mean,
remember those peaches and syrup?
No, I mean, I've never, canned food is not really part of my...
All right, I'll get you with your fancy London metropolitan where you probably lived close to shops when you were growing up.
Yeah, it's true. I did have...
It's not like that. Not like in the Midlands, let me tell you.
Did have corner shop privilege, right? I actually realised, I think this is currently the furthest I've ever lived from a corner shop, in that I can't see the shop from my flat window. And I feel, although I did a couple of days ago go into it in what was, you know, stealthily my pyjamas, right?
Right.
I felt a lot more guilty about it than I would have done, you know, like when it was quite literally at the foot of the block, right? That's okay. I mean, that's basically your living room at that point.
Right.
That is my story.
You tell yourself that if it makes you feel better. Just finally, before we finish, do you think that Theresa May, as there's a kind of case for this week having been a good one for Theresa May?
I think it's actually, yes. I think it's a lot like the hilariously, obviously ill-conceived attempt to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn in 2016, where it has made her position more perilous in that she is reliant on a smaller group of people within her party, you know, from an ideological perspective, the breadth of her cabinet is narrower. But of course, the benefits of that are you're more coherent, you can get your way in cabinet, you have more political flexibility, etc., etc. And because, okay, obviously the slight difference is what protect Jeremy Corbyn is that he still had the support of 50% of the membership plus one. What protects Theresa May is she still has the support of 50% of Labour MPs plus one.
Labour MPs.
Conservative MPs, sorry.
That makes me feel like a lot better about my Ben Bradshaw Bradley.
Yeah, I really shouldn't have picked you up. I think in some ways, kind of, this is kind of the week in which the Brexit options became more sharply defined. Possibilities of a soft Brexit have gone up. The possibility of a kind of catastrophic unplanned Brexit have gone up. But the chances of a kind of planned Canada, which has always been very, very small anyway, have kind of gone out of the
window. We just monkeyed around for so long that they haven't got time to kind of come up with it. Well, you know, as I say every time, we'll return to this subject again in the future.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section that we like to call You Ask Us. I'm joined this week by our political correspondent, Patrick Maguire.
Hello.
Thank you. And so our question is from Ole Larson. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is Jeremy Corbyn actually keeping May in office at this point? If Labour had a more moderate leader, there might be more appetite for toppling her. Now, I think this is actually an interesting question because I think, oddly enough, and obviously, you know, you've been talking to all of these people as well over not just the last week, but of course, you know,
for what feels like forever.
What feels like an eternity. My feeling is it actually weirdly, the area of Brexit where the identity of the Labour leader makes the least difference. It is just not a factor in people's calculations.
Yeah, well, the most important facts at this point are, internal to the Tory party and the immovable red lines that Brussels has set, right? Labour can't change either of those facts, regardless if your leader is Yvette Burnham or Jeremy Corbyn, right?
Yeah, particularly because, yeah, what keeps Conservative Remainers bound to her is, I would say, the fear, but I think actually the stone-cold certainty that whatever they got next would be worse because of where the membership is. What keeps kind of sensible Brexiteers to her is the knowledge that they don't think that there is a real world alternative which reconciles their various red lines or is politically survivable by the 2022 election. I think he makes very little difference to this. However, I feel that there are several other areas where Jeremy Corbyn being Labour leader is significant to the Brexit process. Shall we talk through those? I feel like they are in no particular order. Well, actually, so although I feel like whenever I talk to a kind of centre-right Conservative MP, they'll say, oh, it would be so much easier to, if Andy Cooper were leader of the Labour Party, it would be so much easier for me to break the whip. If this makes any sense, I have no doubt they're sincere, but I don't think that is actually true because MPs just come up with so many excuses not to rebel because MPs don't rebel.
Yeah. Pathologically can't.
Yeah, they don't like doing it. I'm aware that's become my weird obsession. You can be the latest to play this guessing game. How many times out of 10 do you think Jeremy Corbyn rebelled in his most rebellious time Parliament as an MP?
I have to say, a bit of a busman's holiday. I did listen to the podcast in which you revealed the answer.
While you were on holiday. Oh, God.
It's two, isn't it?
Yeah, it's two times out of 10. And this is the problem. I also realised that the way I need to find a way of asking it which doesn't prime people for the fact that it is really low. So I just think, maybe at the margins, right? So maybe instead of having six Tory rebels, you get eight. Seeing as you need 2025 to overcome the Labour rebels going the other way. Actually, the thing I think probably is more of a difference is, let's go through the other four people who could, in theory, I mean, I always feel a bit weird counting Owen Smith as a theoretical Labour leader because there were no circumstances in 2016 in which that leadership election could have been won by, and at the point when that leadership election was lost in November 2015 through the behaviour and decisions of Corbyn sceptics at the very beginning of Corbyn's leadership. So it feels a bit weird to count him as a hypothetical, but let's do it anyway. So what do you think so let's start in the order they finished. So Andy Burnham, what would Andy Burnham's Brexit position be?
I imagine it would be very similar to Corbyn's. Like, you've got to consider he was, MP for Lee, very Brexity. Lee is part of the Wigan Council area. I think that was 65, 35 Leave. You struggle to see how his Brexit policy is any different to Corbyn's. Same with Cooper. If anything, you imagine Cooper and Burnham might be a little bit more Brexity, if anything.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, isn't we shouldn't forget that Andy Burnham kicked off his whole spiel, there's a guy in my constituency who has no mates because he's the only one who doesn't speak Polish. Now, I do think one of the many sort of weird bits of wishful thinking about the 2016 referendum result is that people go, if there had been another Labour leader, it would have been won. All of them said, with the exception of Mary Cray, who obviously didn't make it to the ballot, and this wasn't the only reason, but one of the things that MPs, she said, of course, I will share a platform with David Cameron. This is too important. But they had all already gone, I'm not going to share a platform with David Cameron. They had all said deeply unhelpful things about free movement, right? None of which could be reconciled with staying in. Do I think there was an element of kind of deliberately going, I have to be pro-European in order to stay the leadership and I'm going to be as difficult a pro-European as possible? Yes, but from a practical endpoint perspective, I don't really get what the electoral difference. If you're a voter who doesn't really follow politics, what is the difference between Jeremy Corbyn being an unenthusiastic pro-European out of choice and Yvette Cooper being like, but of course we need to do something about free movement of labour out of expediency?
I read a very interesting, there was a Guardian interview with Andy Burnham during his run for the Manchester mayoralty, in which the author, whose name escapes me, suggested an interesting counterfactual in which Andy Burnham, as obviously married to a Dutch woman, makes an incredibly personal case for the EU and free movement. We stay in the EU and everything's fine. Do you not subscribe to that?
I think with all of the others, I think I find it impossible to sustain the counterfactual. Although he conducted both of his leadership elections very badly, his kind of his natural attributes as a good politician, you know, his warmth, his charisma, his kind of like, you know, his like sort of hunky in a non-threatening way, kind of always, whenever someone goes, but what about this counterfactual with Andy Burnham? I'm quite biased to giving it more house room. The thing is, I simply don't believe that the structure of the referendum campaign wouldn't have played out in a similar way. He didn't want to be involved in Stronger In. I'm sure he would have done, I can imagine him doing that interview and him coming out very, I think probably the difference is I don't think the outcome would have been different in terms of the result, but I can imagine Andy Burnham having quite a good referendum campaign, yeah, doing that interview with, you know, Times, Observer, you know, kind of one of those kind of like those awful, like he's wheeled the wife out interviews, and him being one of the winners of the referendum campaign in the way that Ruth Davison was a winner and, you know, Amber Rudd was a winner of the referendum campaign. The other interesting dynamic which suddenly occurs to me is that if you had a more enthusiastic pro-European as Labour leader, what does that do to Sadiq Khan's public profile? Because he undoubtedly had a good referendum campaign, because in some of the big set piece events, like the hustings event, he did it because he was, you know, the most senior Labour pro-European who was willing to do it.
And then afterwards you become Mr. Soft Brexit, Mr. London is open, Mr.
Yeah,
which, you know, we need to protect the economy, jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, which given the impact of the cuts on parts on various bits of London, and given his own sort of lack of a tangible thing he can point to and say, I have done this as mayor, might mean that we would be talking about him as a more vulnerable incumbent going into 2020. But I simply don't, it's not like Andy Burnham would have every week. This is the thing, right, is I think whenever I read about a game-changing moment in a campaign, well, campaigns aren't about game-changing moments. They're about recurrent themes, like, you know, in the last election, yeah, like Labour, here is a policy offer for everyone paid for by the 1%, right? Which is essentially was their through line throughout all of their policies. The through line of everything the Tories did in 2015 was, you know, long-term economic plan. And like I don't see how I'm married to a Dutch woman has a through line.
Does it not speak, would it not speak to, is it not the emotional case for the European Union that Cameron didn't make? I think that was the point the Guardian journalist in that interview it's your affiliate with a human face.
I'm just kind of in general a bit dubious about the idea that the emotional, particularly after a non-technocratic case for the European Union should have been being made from 2000 onwards. I think obviously the structural problem in 2016, as sort of embodied by Cameron, was turning around after 16 years of saying to his voters, maybe we could leave. And then turning around at the last minute and going, oh God, that was just a joke. Please don't do it. And I don't think Andy Burnham could have got out of the death spiral, although I'm less convinced of that than I was at the start of this conversation. Yvette Cooper, I just think it's open and shut. Then Yvette Cooper would have created exactly the same problem for a different reason to the one Jeremy Corbyn did. There are so many awful things about the referendum campaign etched on my mind. But do you remember when they cleared a day for Labour to have like a day about the referendum. And basically Yvette Cooper like runs on, grabs the mic and goes, hey everyone, has everyone noticed that immigrants come from the EU? And he's just like, why would you do this with 7 days to go? And I know that she thinks and thought that that was helpful, but it's not, right? That it is simply not a sustainable or indeed truthful way to argue for Britain's membership of the European Union, to pretend that we are somehow going to be able to unpick the free movement of people, ignoring the fact that I don't really understand why the Labour Party has decided it thinks capital should have more movement rights than Labour. And so I just don't buy that, then it would be different. Well, I think Liz Kendall is the other interesting counterfactual, because although all of her nominations were, by right, they weren't borrowed, if she had won, she would have had a a much smaller scale version of the Corbyn problem, which is that it is hard to work out how she would have built a shadow cabinet in which the core positions were not filled by political opponents. And she'd already had to resile from some of her early stuff about hating that controls on immigration mug in order to get the nominations. So I feel like she would have ended up having to strike a more kind of like, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, maybe immigration is actually bad. And so in another way, you kind of end up in the Ed Miliband position of like anguish triangulation towards an immigration position that she didn't really believe in. And I, again, don't think that would have been different for the result. And in terms of the aftermath, I think actually the interesting thing is, right, is so why did the SNP end up with their very maximal, we don't like this result, we need to have a second referendum, Brexit is bad position? The answer is because Nicola Sturgeon woke up or didn't, but that morning she felt, she's spoken about this publicly, a sense of who she was had been taken away from her. And she believed that pro-Europeans would agree with her. I mean, that's certainly how I felt the, again, I didn't go to sleep, but yeah, and that's certainly how I felt the morning after. And I suddenly occurs to me that the interesting question is whether or not with Liz Kendall or Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham, one of them says something that, you know, kind of, it's sort of the reverse of, yeah, like the Trigger Article 50 Now clip. When you actually watch it, what happens is he's kind of come on in, he's kind of like briefed, like, and I have my lines and I'm going to take about this result. And the presenter goes, well, should Article 50 be triggered? And he goes, yeah, that should happen now. And he doesn't really think about what he said. But that, of course, is his default and actually held position. My question, the interesting thing that has only just occurred to me now is, would we have a situation where it's the morning after, you've got a knackered pro-European politician who's felt that horror that Sturgeon and Tim Farron had both felt, who goes, of course, we need to stay in the single market.
Or we should stop it.
Yeah, do you have a situation where Labour policy... Because in an odd way, one of the things about the referendum result is you have a lot of politicians who are triangulating around things that they said at a time when they were tired. Yeah, they were shattered both physically and emotionally. And there's quite a lot of kind of going, okay, well, we can't, you know, you obviously kind of can't come out and go, you know, if you're Nicola Sturgeon, you can't sort of turn around and go, so it turns out most Remain voters weren't as upset about this result as I was, right? You know, it did not recast Scottish politics in the way that she intuitively felt it would. Although I do think her insight into what she felt she'd lost out in the morning of that referendum is a massive asset to her as a politician, and is one of the reasons why the SNP is, I think, doing a very effective job of talking to wavering no voters in a way than I think it wasn't before. But does that mean Labour now has a more pro-European policy because of that initial kind of like, oh, I don't like this? And again, I kind of think not, because although kind of a lot of Liz Kendall's strongest supporters were people who the day after were like, no, we have to stop this. She wasn't, you know, I can't quite remember what it was she tweeted about the result, but it wasn't like, this is awful. This is awful, but it wasn't like, no, we have to stop this. She wasn't one of the kind of like immediate stoppers. Neither, of course, was Yvette Cooper, who talked about how it was a problem of small towns and immigration.
But the one person who was Owen Smith.
Yeah.
Who in that Moore interview, when he first went for leadership, did the handbrake turn towards, let's have a second referendum and let's stop it, essentially. That was the delayed onset reaction that a pro-European Labour leader would have had on the morning after the referendum, right?
Yeah.
It was to say, well, this is mental. We need to stop it.
Yeah. The interesting question is, one, would you have got the 2017 election? Two, what would the result of the 2017 election have been if Labour had had an unambiguously anti position?
Much worse,
yeah,
for Labour. Like, yeah. You wouldn't have held on. You don't have Paul Farrelly holding on by 20 votes in Newcastle-under-Lyme. You don't have Gloria DePiero holding on Ashfield. You just have dozens of Mansfields, don't you? You have in-Congress seats falling to the Tories because of the purple firewall.
Yeah, and this is the thing. You also, the thing that, well, yeah, the thing that happened in the 2017 election is everyone who managed to one reason or other go into the election having put Brexit to one side. So whether it's Ruth Davison saying, of course, I'll fight for our right in the single market, but we need to not have another independence referendum. Or if it's Jeremy Corbyn going, of course, free movement will end and we accept the referendum result. But what about my policy offer? They did very well because they successfully fought and won the argument about what their election was about. If it had been about Brexit, then does stuff like the dementia tax get kind of any airtime? Does the election just become, well, here's a manifesto, but no one cares about it? Yeah.
Well, that was well limited so well because it was notionally a Brexit election, pitched as a Brexit election, but was never forced a Brexit election.
Yeah, and so people
because they refused to engage with the terms of the debate as Theresa May imagined them.
Yeah, and so people just felt yanked around by Theresa May. So, yeah, this thing. So, with a smaller parliamentary Labour Party, okay, I mean, admittedly, Labour doesn't have the numbers to stop Brexit now. So basically, that doesn't really change anything.
But this is where it becomes interesting in terms of internal Tory dynamics, because the mantra for both sides of the Tory debate at the moment, i.e. The payroll, who want wavering MPs to support May's deal, and rebels, who want to rebel and get her to rip up Chequers, is the mantra on both sides is, if you do X, we will get Corbyn. That is the line for the rebels who say, you know, like Ben Bradley resigning yesterday, saying seats like mine will fall to Labour if we push ahead with this. And the government payroll after the meeting of the 1922 committee were saying, look, we have to unite around the Prime Minister or we get a 1997 style landslide, which is where, you know, Corbyn's ambiguity on Brexit delivers the result we get in 2017 and then creates the situation where actually Corbyn is bringing down Labour's neck, down the Tories' neck, and becomes actually, in that respect, a really important figure in the internal Tory debate on Brexit.
Yeah, because, yeah, the fact that, and although there are lots of good reasons to, yeah, the argument that the next election will be a very different one to 2017, it's not stupid, right? I don't know if it's true, but it's not. Immediate, it's not obviously false. However, because no one can confidently say Labour will not get the extra 10 seats they need to form some type of government, yeah, so that is actually the big impact of Corbyn on Tory and Hilde, is the idea of him as a presence at the gate. And that's, yeah, and that simply wouldn't have happened with any other leader for the essential reason that, yeah, I Owen Smith only, you know, only exists as one of our hypotheticals because Corbyn is already leader. And again, I mean, you may disagree, but I simply cannot conceive of any hypothetical where at the point that Owen Smith becomes a leadership candidate, any leadership candidate could have beaten Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, say part that for a second and say he did, right? The whole point of Smith's leadership then would have been to indulge the fiction that they got rid of Corbyn because he was equivocal on the EU. And then, as we said before, you see a Labour that is much more anti-Brexit or much, much softer, or, you know, can't have that constructive ambiguity. With worse results electorally.
Yeah. And I think with either of the other three, yeah, I mean, there are many reasons why I think if Yvette Burnham had led Labour into the 2017 election, they would have got a better result. But the most stupid is the 2017 election only arises out of Corbyn's perceived weakness. If you did have another Labour leader who had had a better position in the polls in 2017, there is no 2017 election. It only exists to get Theresa May this guaranteed bumper majority. So the hypothetical there doesn't work. The question I have is, do you think, let's say that, Yvette Burnham is Labour leader in 2017 and the polls show, let's say, a small Labour lead of 5 points, but Yvette Burnham is trailing the Tories on economic competence, which I suspect is probably where we would be if either any of the... Yeah, we'd effectively have kind of mid-period Miliband-style polling. Do you think the you can't let Labour in dynamic would work both ways, or do you think it would it would be less, because there would be more of it if you're Nicky Morgan. You're just like, I can live with Yvette Cooper being Prime Minister.
I think you would have the mutineers of old, i.e. the pro-mutineers, as you say, going through the division lobbies with someone like, Burnham, Cooper, isn't sacrilegious, is it? They are, in the minds of most of Westminster, temperate, moderate, sort of very conventional, palatable to Middle England politicians, as you say. Like the whole, in that respect, yeah, I think it is one way, because you can't, invoke Andy Burnham as a bogeyman, can you?
So just the idea of something like, eat your greens or Andy Burnham will nationalise your house.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And so I think actually that is the big difference. It's not about the internal dynamics of May's leadership, but the dynamics of rebellion are quite different.
Yeah, well, exactly. Is Andy Burnham, Yvette Cooper in the national interest, is a ticket Tory MPs can buy, whereas Corbyn is doing the thing we want, but we are so genuinely terrified of him and everything he stands for, because he has, shifted the window or whatever. Yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. Make sure to check out the rest of the podcasts in our family. The back half covers arts, Seriously covers pop culture, and Political Football will every Monday be covering the World Cup.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.